This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of the second installment of Talk Show, a set of events dedicated to exploring professions whose intricacies are often wondered at but rarely explored. Talk Show is hosted by David Levine and features straight man Eben Clem. Guests for the second installment were child actor Spencer List, Army National Guard recruiter Marisha Rowe Watson, and Brandon Downing on the films of Mario Bava. It took place on June 21st, 2011.
Welcome to the topic of tonight's monologue. Sideman or straight man? We'll get to that in a second. So you all are here at talk show number two. These are shows that we've been doing for a while. Cabinet has been nice enough to host the last few. They're always about people with interesting jobs. That's the main topic of the show, which is to say, no artists and no creatives. Although we're making a slight exception tonight because we do have an actor, but he's 13, so it's different. Because being a child actor is an interesting job. So, the format of the show has slowly calcified into this kind of crypto entertainment. It follows the form of a regular talk show, so you get a monologue from the host, which I'm delivering right now, and then I will interview our first guest, who is, let me see if I get the designations right, our first guest is Sergeant First Class Marisha Rowe Watson, is that right? Who is the station commander of the Harlem Armory recruiting office. She's an Army National Guard recruiter. And the format is usually I'll interview them for about 10, 15 minutes, and then you get to ask questions for 10 to 15 minutes. During this time, the sideman or straight man, or rain man, will be mixing a cocktail, which is also sort of turned into an aspect of the show. Eben Clem is a master mixologist. Actually, that is a designated term. He is a master mixologist. And for every show, he invents a cocktail, which we usually try in the interlude after the first guest. And then at the end of the evening, we will name it. That's also up to you guys. Eben will serve these cocktails while our second. There's in addition to interviewing people with interesting jobs, there's an interlude section called Minor Obsessives, or at least I call it Minor Obsessives, which is less about your day job and more about what you do when you should be working at your day job. So in this case, Brandon Downing is going to give a 10-minute slide talk on the films of Mario Bava. Hopefully the talk show does not turn out like this, but you never know. And then Eben will, as Brandon delivers this talk, Eben will distribute the cocktails, which we will all try and discuss them. And then our third guest, Spencer List, is going to come and talk about the life of a 13-year-old actor. And now for the monologue. But it's not a monologue this time, because generally
The difference between what you just said is the monotone, and this now is the monologue, right?
Yeah. Okay, so here's today's question. Eben has traditionally been referred to in less editorially demanding contexts, i.e. the Gershwin Hotel or other places where we've done the show, as a sideman. This is how I always refer to him. However, Cabinet was like, that's not right. They're actually known as the straight man. A sideman is a trumpet player, right? So we made this change without asking him, and then he was introduced as a straight man, and he objected immediately, thereby demonstrating that he is indeed a straight man. But in this case, in the intro, and then he noticed again, and I said, oh yeah, I'll take care of it, we'll change the press text back to straight man, and a side man, and I conveniently forgot.
You didn't do anything.
No, I didn't. So we're actually kind of... Well, I mean, the point is, can we call him a sideman, or do we have to call him a straight man if we're doing the talk show format? Or is there another name we could come up with?
Sidekick.
Sidekick.
Then you're a
That's like Robin, or like.
The problem with sidekick is that it automatically implies sort of, you know, secondary position. Straight man fulfills a role, but it's your show, of course. But
it was until like ten minutes ago. Maybe sidecar
is good.
Sidecar just implies that like somebody, not me, of course, because I'm driving, but somebody's just sitting on you. Is that really what you want? Is that really gonna? Well, sidecar because it's a classic cocktail, right? You don't want to be reduced to your job.
Sideman was better because we don't have a trumpet player. What we do is we play the music of cocktails here, so it seemed more appropriate and more congenial. But maybe it was just about not being asked, which was my biggest problem. And that makes me a straight man for it being sort of set up that way. There
seem to be a few ways out of this labyrinth that you're standing behind.
Well, that's why we are asking the audience.
Okay, so basically, I don't want to make this too democratic, and you guys are already naming the cocktail as it is, so you've had your say. But I guess the question is, like, he'd rather be called a sideman. Is it fair to call him a sideman when a sideman is really just reserved for music, or do we have to call him a straight man if we're doing the standard talk show format? I don't want him to be my sidekick. I spend enough time with him anyway, and like, it really just makes it seem like he'd have an outfit and be like Kid Flash or something.
Sideman is fine.
Just
give him an instrument or something.
And a straight man tends to also be on the same stage with the performer, reacting, so in which it's actually more of a sideman.
I just googled Johnny Carson, and the man was a sideman.
He was.
Slash alcoholic.
It works great.
What's really at stake is whether I have a decision at all. I mean, I think that's what's really what's sort of, do you make all the decisions or not?
I think the audience is in an advisory position here, but right. I think Sidemen.
Okay,
think
so Sidemen, we're going to go back.
I think we're going to Sidemen.
I'm happy with that.
I mean, actually, the people in the front row who are like, I think we should move on. In the end, they're the ones who really exert all the power, because we do it for you. What? Oh, why don't we call him Sideman Sick?
How about Sideman 6?
Okay.
The bigger issue is that we thought this would be funnier than it turned out.
I learned a lot, actually.
We did learn a lot.
So Sideman with an asterisk saying Cabinet is not responsible for this designation.
Sure.
I love that.
Sideman Sick it is, then.
All right.
All right, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So... our first guest has spent 11 years in the military, 8 of them as an Army National Guard recruiter. She deployed to Iraq for a year in 2003, and she is now the station commander of the Harlem Armory Recruiting Office. Please welcome Sergeant First Class Marisha Rowe Watson. I'm going to turn off the screen because it's probably just making things hotter in here. Here, this is yours. So thank you very much for joining us. It was difficult to get you. One has to go through a very interesting chain of command actually to get in touch with someone to do this. But I'm really glad you came. This is an occupational hazard. Hey, can someone shut down? Sure, lower Evan's mic for a little while.
I'll just put it off the side.
All right. I guess the first question is, now you're the station commander, so how does one move up the ladder as a recruiter? Where do you start, and what are the different stages?
Well, this new station commander title is fairly new. In the past, we were all just known as RR NCOs, recruiting and retention NCOs. When you come on board as a recruiter, recruiters are full-time, so... Once you go to school and you become qualified to do your job as a recruiter, everybody's a recruiter. No, actually. So as of late, depending on the rank that's in the station, the highest ranking individual will be titled station commander.
Okay.
So because I am the highest ranking person, then I've given the title station commander.
And is being the station commander easier than being the first-year recruiter?
Absolutely not. Because what comes with the title is experience and then you have to pass on the experience. You have to mentor your newer recruiters to make sure that they're doing the right thing. So I have my job, plus I have to monitor what they're doing.
And when you, okay, so just backing up them, there's that station in Times Square, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're a open first level recruiter, are you recruiting out of an office? Are you going to schools? Or how does it go when you start?
Well, the National Guard recruiting command is different. It's unique from the regular Army, because regular Army bases, they have what they call storefronts. So they're like in like a regular shop or in a mall or wherever. National Guard recruiters, we are in local armories. So wherever you are, if you're in Manhattan, we have one armory in Manhattan. I'm in the Harlem Armory. Actually, there's another armory on 23rd Street. So depending on where you're located, we'll have an armory, and that's where usually our National Guard recruiters will be set up at.
Okay, so they come. So people who want to be in the National Guard come and find you.
Yeah, they do.
Okay. All right, so then you're set up in the Army, meaning there's multiple recruiters in the Armory, but
absolutely,
they're always there, so you can go by.
Mm-hmm.
Are Armories still functional?
Absolutely.
They still store arms?
That's why we still have a guard. The guard is here to protect the state, and in any kind of state emergency, that's why we have our Armories.
So all right.
Our guard is, they move to the Armories, and they get their weapons. If they have to come out full force, that's why we still have Armories to this day.
Okay. So when someone comes in, they come in and they're like, I want to sign up for the National Guard. I mean, that doesn't seem like there's a lot of recruiting going on. It actually just seems like you're waiting and they look.
Not really. I mean, we go out. We're not just situated in the armories. Even though I said that, yeah, we are located in the Army, a recruiter job is all around. It's not just sitting in the office. It's being in the streets, in your government car, going from Manhattan to the Bronx to Brooklyn to Queens, getting police checks, you know, talking to parents, being counselors, advisors, friends. I mean, it's an all-around job.
Being counselors, advisors, friends to recruits.
Absolutely.
Okay. So when they I wasn't trying to denigrate the job. I guess what I was asking is, I guess it's not like being a missionary. It's not like you're taking people off the street and being like, why don't you join the National Guard? These people are coming in. So when they come in for their first interview, or when they come in, what kind of conversation do you have with them?
The most important thing people want to know when they come into the Guard is how the Guard can benefit them and what the Guard has to offer to improve their situation. I mean, I've met doctors, I've met lawyers, I've met people that are dropouts from high school. So different genres of people, they come to me, they come to the Guard for all different reasons.
And is there a protocol, like when you prepare to be a recruiter, is there a way of talking about it? Are there mistakes you can make when you're talking
Absolutely.
To a potential recruit?
Absolutely. I mean, you know what? You learn from your mistakes. You go to formal training, because we all go to what's called recruiting school.
Right.
And recruiting school doesn't teach you to be a recruiter. It just teaches you the basics. What you need to know about the regulation and how not to get yourself in trouble legally when you enlist someone. As far as the day-to-day ins and outs, talking to people, it's just you live and you learn.
So what was your like worst rookie mistake?
Honestly, it was a medical issue that, not for me, but the individual was coming in and they had this medical issue, and I wrote it on a fax and I sent it somewhere, and I didn't know that there was this health law, HIPAA, it's called HIPAA, where certain medical information should not be, you know, transmitted in certain forms, and that was my first mistake. But I learned, you know. But like I said, you live and you learn on this job. So.
And then when you're like the rest of the time when you're driving around, when you're sort of taking care of them, if you get recruited for the National Guard, the recruiters are still keeping an eye on you until you get into a company, or until?
That's a good question, actually. When a person gets enlisted, the recruiter is responsible for that person until they actually get to training and back. So, you know, I'm responsible to make sure that person gets their military ID card, gets their medical stuff squared away. If they have family or dependents, I have to make sure that those dependents, they get, you know, situated if when the person's in training, to make sure that they're medical. It's a lot. It's an all around kind of thing.
And what's the normal caseload? Like how many recruits does each recruiter handle?
It depends. I mean, honestly, I've managed 10, 15 recruits in the same month. You know, so it's a lot if you think about it. It's a lot of work.
And you're generally keeping an eye on them for about a month.
Did you ever
say anything, or did you ever have an employee say anything? Like somebody came in and they were like, "I really want to join the National Guard," and then somehow the recruiter they got just kind of put them off and they left.
Or? Absolutely, and I find myself guilty of that too, because sometimes I'm overwhelmed, and if I have too many things dealing with at once, sometimes I'll tend to put something off, and I'll say, "You know what, this is happening. Can you call me in a week or so or whatever?" That sometimes you have to do that. And being a great recruiter, you know, you have to have excellent time management, because it's just all these things happening, not just with new recruits, but people that you're trying to put in, and it's just...
So it seems like the real art of the recruit, it isn't so much like persuading people to join,
it's really
so much
not.
As it really is like taking care of them once they join.
And honestly, after doing recruiting for 8 years, I don't have to go out to every job fair. I don't have to go out in the streets every day to talk to people to get people to join. People, they're calling up the 800 Go Guard number to sign up to the Guard. So my main mission is to just write the contracts and do all the administrative duties to get that person in.
But that's because you're the station commander, right?
Every RRNCO has that duty. They're responsible to make sure that they administratively prepare the people to get contracted.
What's the worst reason for joining the National Guard that you ever ran into?
Wow. That's a hard question to ask a recruiter.
Well, but I guess what I'm saying is, you said people do, you said people do it for all kinds of reasons, like it could be patriotism.
The worst
like,
reason? Let me think about this one. I have to think about it, really. The worst reason. Probably to get away from their parents. I've gotten that one. I need to get away from my parents. I've got that.
And what do you say to them?
I said, well, this is a way to do that. So yeah.
What's your first?
I've told them straight out that I'm not willing to work with you. And whether it be this person had a significant criminal history, or I just think morally having a conversation with somebody, not that my values has to, cover what everybody else's value is, but it's just sometimes you just meet some people that you know, if I let you into the organization, it's going to be bad, and it's going to look bad on me as a recruiter, so I just say no.
Is it hard to say no?
I'm not going to say it's hard to say no. It's not at all, but you'll have the young rookie recruiter who's struggling that'll reconsider, and they'll say, all right, I'm going to work with this person, but it's not necessarily for the good of the guard. And because I've been doing this so long and very successful at it, the Guard is my family, and I want to make sure that I bring the best possible people that I can bring.
And very successful in Guard terms means you've brought a ton of people in, or they've all worked out well, or they've
absolutely
stayed in the Guard?
Absolutely. I mean, I'd say a good 95% of the people that I enlisted so far are careerists, meaning they will stay in the Guard for at least 20 years. So
how did you get into recruiting? I mean, how did you pick recruiting after doing your training?
I didn't pick recruiting. Recruiting kind of picked me. I started off when I enlisted in the Guard, a freshman in college, and never really wanted to do recruiting. My MOS, my military occupation specialty, was to be a truck driver. That's what I thought. You know what, if I joined the Army, I wanted to do something different that females don't normally do. And I went to training to drive this big old tractor trailer, and through the process of doing that, and people met me here or there, and they said, you know what, we like you, you have this charisma about you, I think you'd be a good recruiter, and that's when I applied for the job, and I got hired, so
there's actually recruiters recruiting recruiters.
Exactly.
Okay, right. All right.
Exactly.
And so, but did you miss truck drive?
No, I drove trucks in Iraq for a year. It's really nothing that I miss about that.
There's nicer places to drive trucks.
Absolutely. So I volunteered, so it was a good experience because I was able to get hands-on with the vehicles, but it was also very dangerous. So.
Was Iraq surprising? I mean, did you expect that you would...
I didn't expect that I was going to be this female on the battlefield. I knew I was going to drive trucks, but I didn't realize that the support line was the battlefield. And, you know, the supply routes were the battlefield because we were the ones that they were targeting.
So. Right. And you'd been recruiting for a while, and then you got called up.
I was recruiting for a year before my deployment in 2003, yeah.
Okay. I've got one more question, then I'm going to turn it over to you. So how is National Guard, if you guys, the Army recruiters have storefronts,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Is their job very different from your job? If you guys see each other at a party, are you like, wimp? Like, or...
And you know what? I tend to not, I try not to bash other branches.
I'm not asking you to bash. I'm actually just really asking you if it's very different.
We have our differences, to be honest, because I'm going to tell you the main difference that I find. As National Guard recruiters, we tend to be more stationary because if I'm a recruiter for 10, 15 years, I'm going to be the recruiter in that area for 10 years. I may have the same phone number for 10, 15 years. Compared to, let's say, a regular Army recruiter, they do what's called PCS. They permanently change stations every 3 years. So with that being said, they don't have any loyalty to where they stand.
Or to a community.
A community. And so you find where they'll just do whatever, and sometimes they do bad things, and then they know they're not going to see this person because they're PCSing next month. And so they don't have that relationship that we have with the community.
Have you always been based at the Armory in Harlem?
Always.
The whole town?
The whole time. I've had the same number for 8 years.
Oh, wow. And, and where were you before you moved to New York? Or did you join up there? Have you been there the whole time?
I joined up in New York, and my recruiter was a recruiter in Harlem.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Same Armory, since my contract, everything.
Cool. All right, I will leave it. I open it to you guys. Kidding. Thank you.
Can you talk about the various insignia on your uniform?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, this one is my branch affiliation, AG, Adjutant General, because I'm a recruiter. This is my medal tab, and here is my Army Achievement Medals. Here is the Department of Defense Service Medal. I have, actually, this is the Department of Defense Service Medal. This one is the GWAT Medal, Global War on Terror. This is my Iraq Campaign Medal. This is my Army Reserve Component Medal, and it has an M for mobilization, meaning I have been deployed. And my non-commissioned officer medal, and my Army Service Ribbon. Whenever somebody graduates from basic training, the first ribbon they'll get is the Army Service Ribbon.
Okay.
And I have here, what is this, my rifle badge, I'm a marksman, and I have my driver badge, and this is my recruiter badge.
Wow.
And this is the 3rd Army Combat insignia patch. This is fairly new because we changed over the uniforms from the greens to the blues. So they added this new combat badge. So if somebody's been in combat, they'll have a badge.
What is the, where would the next medal go? On the tab, I mean, on the tab on the left?
Okay.
Where would the next one go? Not medal, but where would the next?
Oh, I've just changed this. If I get, like, more medals.
Yeah.
Because it has to be in order of precedence, military
oh,
precedence.
Oh, wow.
So every time I get a medal, I have to reorg this whole thing.
I see.
Yeah.
But is it do you slot them into something? Is it a slot kind of
normally,
system?
Normally, but I try to be high speed, and they have this place that does them, and they stay nice and flat. So, but Yeah, usually you could slide them onto a little bar.
Uh-huh.
This one is done. Somebody pre-done.
I see.
So it's actually a whole unit. It's not the
yes,
okay.
It's a whole unit.
So you'd have to retire the whole thing if you get another one.
But I get a new rabbit.
But
yes.
You both. Wow. Is there a procedure for getting? I mean, for getting rid of the old one? Do you have to formally? I mean, can you just throw it out, or do you have to formally give it back?
No. Your ribbons are a permanent order, so you'll always have those.
So, but I mean, once you have to get a new set, if you get another medal.
Well, I will definitely have to throw this out.
Okay, then you, but you just throw it out. You don't have to deaccession it or something.
Not necessarily throw it out, like discard it.
Can you sell them on eBay?
I wouldn't do that.
Claire?
So you mentioned that once you've signed on with someone, you're responsible for seeing that they get to training.
Absolutely.
So I guess I'm wondering if either in your experience or your colleague's experience, you've signed someone up who gets cold feet and is, you know, at the last minute, like, I can't do this.
Absolutely.
You're on the line, right? So have you had an experience where you've either had to talk them back from the ledge or sort of go out and find, just basically you have to deliver them to training, right? That's on you?
It's on me in a way. I try to explain to people, yes, I'm going to take a loss because recruiters are given missions. Your assigned mission is 18 for the year. So if I recruited 18 people and one person decided that they're not going to go to training, then I'm going to suffer a loss. I'm not going to try to talk the person out of not wanting to go because I'm suffering a loss. I usually tell them, you know what, this is going to affect you because the type of discharge you're going to get. You may get a general under honorable conditions.
Before training, they've signed something.
Absolutely.
They're contracted.
They have an obligation. So I explain that to them. And I don't have to explain it to them. They already knew that prior to signing a contract that they have an obligation. So I just reiterate what their obligation was, the consequences, especially if that person is thinking about, you know, a government job down the road. So there's a lot of negative consequences for, you know, signing a contract and then not following through.
So they'll never get hired by the government?
I wouldn't say that they would never, because, it depends on the type of discharge that they get. If they get a general discharge, it may or may not affect them, but if they get a dishonorable discharge, then absolutely, they'll probably never get hired by the government.
What happens to you if you fall short of your mission?
Nothing happens to me.
No, maybe not, but are they demerits? Are they like...
Honestly, if you have a trend of being, you know, not making your mission, then, yeah, a recruiter can get cut for not making their mission. You know, I've been successful all this time. If I don't make my mission 1 year, I'm not going to lose my job because I didn't make my mission.
Does your mission increase as you climb the ranks?
It depends. Right now, the guard is over strength. We actually have more people than we can afford to pay. So it's you know, I don't see the mission increasing any further. Probably 3 years ago, yeah.
So it's still 18. Different. It's still 18 a year for everyone who's in the
right now. Yes.
So, question for you. Two-part question. One, is it true that flat-footed people cannot join the military?
Kinda. Not really. It depends. It depends. There's certain levels of flat-footedness.
Okay.
Some people are really flat feet.
So zero arch.
Some people still have an arch, you know, where... So it depends. You go through a physical exam or the doctor is going to examine you. I have recruited people that have flat feet, and mm-hmm. they've gone through. But never. Some people, they have it terrible than others. So it depends.
Okay. Good. That was just interesting, curious. Yeah. But the second part is, now what happens if there's Operation Disaster, like Fight Club type situation, and someone wants to come out and just destroy the United States, or say the Chinese get crazy and they're coming to invade us? So then National Guard is who's going to protect us in that situation. If it's all anarchy and craziness, they're the first line of defense.
No, I wouldn't say that's true. Active Army is the first line of defense. The National Guard, our mission is to protect the state. So if it's something pertaining to the state, i.e. terrorist strike downtown New York, 9/11 occurred, that's when the Guard was mobilized. That's our mission. That's our territory. So we were mobilized before even the active army.
Okay.
So that's where we would come in.
Cool.
Yeah.
How many people, I'm sure a lot of people come in with kind of a glory
job in mind. Like, I want to be a jet fighter, or I want to be David Petraeus. Mm-hmm. what's your job as a recruiter to sort of manage their expectations into more realistic goals?
I try not to manage, actually. I try to mentor. I try to direct counsel. It depends on what the individual is qualified for, because I just break it down and I try not to sugarcoat it. I just let them know. The bottom line is there's this test called the ASVAB test, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Exam. That's the test that determines what you do and how far you go. So, yeah, I just tell them it doesn't matter if you've got awards up to here or you're qualified in this. At the end of the day, this test determines what you're qualified to do in the military. So.
Wait, did you have a question?
I wonder what's your have you had any situations where you felt a kind of personal closeness to people, developing friendships or through this process, and how do you manage this? Is this something that goes against your job, or I'm sure there's codes for this. I'm talking on a more personal, emotional level.
Emotional?
No, I'm not in a romantic way, but
okay,
I'm saying you
okay.
might.
Okay.
A friendship is emotional. It's not in a romantic way.
I hear you. Okay. And as a recruiter, I have to be careful how I define friendship, because I have my duties as a recruiter and also my duties as a non-commissioned officer in the military. Having this rank comes with a lot of, you know, responsibilities. So, yes, I do in some situations feel close to an individual because I may relate to what that person is going through. Either it'll be, you know, family or their reasons for wanting to join. And over the years, I have developed friendships with my recruits, but I still try to keep it on a professional level, and so they know that at the end of the day, I'm Sergeant First Class Marie Chereau, and you're Private So-and-so.
What should we call you?
You can call me Marisha.
Are there any other questions? Cold.
Just curious. Cold. Can you use the text? Oh, yeah, Cold.
For the recording.
So how, in terms of your approach as a recruiter, how has your year as a truck driver in Iraq informed your approach or changed it at all?
I wouldn't say it has changed that, because even though my military occupation is truck driver, I really, up until my deployment in Iraq, I didn't have a lot of experience driving trucks. My main point, or my main selling point as a recruiter really is my college education. You know, having gone to John Jay College, having gotten my master's degree through the military, and just my approach of sharing my story of this little girl that migrated from Kingston, Jamaica. Here I am in the military, living my dream, have a career, and it's all great. So that's the story that I tell when I go out and I recruit. So.
Do you still go out and recruit? Or?
Yeah, absolutely.
And where do you go, like job fairs? Or?
Job fairs, and you know, from time to time, I may do like a little street visit. You asked me when I was standing outside, you know, do I have any weird on-the-spot type kind of recruit things that I do? And some of it is unintentional. Like, I went to, like, a jazz bar with my ex-boyfriend, and the musician there was, you know, pretty good. And I was, like, you know, in conversation after the performance, I was like, hey, you know, the military has a band. and he was interested, and he actually auditioned. He never joined, but he actually auditioned.
So wait. So for musicians, you can audition for the National Guard?
Absolutely, we have a band.
But do you have to go through the other tests, or are you just getting through?
You do.
No flat-footed musicians.
But you can audition first and then take the test.
Actually, usually we like to make sure you pass the test first, and then you can audition. But usually musicians are very smart, so they have no problems passing the test anyway.
Cool. All right, then. Sergeant Rowe, thank you. Oh, yeah, sorry.
One last question. If you had to pick one person from here who you thought would be the best possible recruit, who would you pick? That's other than David.
You got to volunteer.
I don't want to single anyone out.
Oh, come on.
I've got to say, right. this weirdly seems to happen every time we have an interview. Last time there was a perfumer here. He was the guy who invented Calvin Klein Eternity. He was this, you know, and at some point somebody was like, "So what does this room smell like?" And he was like, "Nope." Absolutely not. He's like, "I'm sorry, I shut it off before I got here." So I don't think we're gonna get that out of here. But it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, so Evan, what have you been making?
What I've been making is that's a good start.
Use your mic.
I was upstate at my parents' farm. I'm starting a garden there myself this summer, and so I took back a whole bunch of rhubarb and I cooked that down and I clarified that with lime juice, and it's a gin and vermouth, so it's supposed to be kind of refreshing and springy. There's a little bit of poignancy.
Use your microphone.
Is it back on? Yes. There's a bit of poignancy with this cocktail because the last cocktail we did for this event, the Pepperazzi was what the audience named it.
Named by one Clara Bishop.
The Pepperazzi was the very last cocktail I put on an amen. The idea was that not only do you know you design and name the cocktail that I designed, but it would go on a cocktail menu. That I was writing at the time, and the Pepperazzi was the very last cocktail I created for the company I was working at before I was asked to resign. And so it wasn't because of the Pepperazzi, although it was frustrations that I expressed both physically and verbally at not being able to get the ingredients in order to create it. So I think that's kind of...
Oh, it was for the Pepperazzi?
Well, it was for that menu. It was for that specific training class where I would be putting forth 10 drinks, including that drink.
This is something that's actually worth talking about at another point, because Evan had kind of like... Well, I'm loud. Evan had kind of a Billy Jack moment at his job, and I mean, if you ask him about it afterwards, I'm sure he'll tell you all about it. He might even reenact.
We have a lot of
you.
Set. We can demonstrate it in a lot
but
of.
But then
ways,
the whole question of can you actually do a take this job and shove it routine? You know, if you work in the luxury goods sector, right? If you work in a luxury industry, can you still have a really blue collar moment of acting out? And can the people really get behind you if you do? So we can discuss that. We can discuss that later.
So the drink is Plymouth Gin, Dolin Vermouth, reduced rhubarb, clarified lime juice, and lavender from my garden here. I have another batch going to come around in the second act. So
oh, awesome! So that's going to come around.
So we will before the. Last interviewee, but after Brandon, before Spencer, we will start throwing out, start thinking about drink names.
And remember,
knowing that there's no extant menu that it will go on.
But remember also that you're naming what might be the very first drink of the very second act of Evan's career. So you know, so this is a significant one. So we make it good. All right. Without further ado, Brandon Downing and the films of Mario Bava. And the microphone of horror.
I will use this microphone.
Okay, what we see on the screen right here is actually the great Elkie Summer from the film by Mara Bava, Barren Blood, which we won't be showing tonight. What I'd like to do is, in a short amount of time, give a little bit of background about Mario Bava, why I obsess with him and about him more than the 700 or 800 things that I also obsess about. A little bit of background about what makes him such a unique filmmaker. A little bit about me, a particular obsession I have, which I've done for about the last 10 years, artist, is been cutting up and reconfiguring films, usually with fresh soundtracks, fresh dialogue, different subtitles, rearranging things. The films of Mario Bava have been particularly... precious to redo because they're well, you might call them schlock in today's parlance, but really, Mario Bava is a unique director of what you would call in Italy the giallo tradition, which is a sort of morbid, violent, gory, psychosexual, perversely shot genre of horror flick. He's not the most famous director of the gialli. That would probably be someone named Dario Argento, who many of you have probably heard of. Aldo Novo or Lucio Fulci is another director. But Mario Bava is uniquely... a unique tradition in Italian cinema. He came rather than Dario Argento, who came from a cineast and in critic position. Mario Bava was sort of a lifetime industry man. His father was one of the pioneers of silent Italian films. Mario himself was a cinematographer, and for him it was always image, 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 image. He got his first directorial job, real brief history, by replacing the great French director Jacques Tournier, who did so many great film noirs in the 40s. On a Hercules film, Hercules slash caveman film, for American International Pictures in 1959. He didn't receive a director's credit, but the film ended up being so successful that the producers said, okay, now, Mario, you've done such a great job directing, you can direct any picture you want, do whatever you want. Mario Bava said, I want to base a film on a story by Nikolai Gogol. Which in the end became a movie called Black Sunday, which had nothing to do with Nikolai Gogol and had a lot to do with resurrected witches, Iron Maiden masks crushing women's eyeballs, and revenge of a 17th century vampire on a contemporary Caucasian town in the 18th century. The thing with Mario is that because he's a cinematographer, pure cinematographer, it's really all about the image. A lot of his actors, among them Boris Karloff, Elke Sommer, Joseph Cotten, were continually kind of upset with the fact that he would train these fisheye and extreme wide-angle lenses on them, on these garish, overpopulated sets, and completely distort their figures as actors. He didn't even really care about what they said in the dialogue, because everything, this being the era of sort of international swinger horror pictures, was translated into 30 or 40 languages anyway. So basically, he would build these completely unrealistic sets, populate it with actors that he didn't really care if they spoke or not or what they said, and it was mainly about getting his image across. But at the same time, he had a real affinity for key horror elements. Excuse me. One of his films called Bay of Blood, basically you could call an Italian shot-for-shot pre-make of Friday the 13th Part 1 and Part 2. It was the first time in a horror film that you'd seen something like teenagers sneaking off, breaking into houses, having sex without adult supervision, and because of that, they're impaled by a spear through their bed. He was one of the pioneers of using first-person camera shots, so where you could see through with the eyes of the killer as he stalks his next victim. Also, a clip that I'm about to show, this first clip, is really from a film of his called Kill Baby Kill, which is actually kind of a stunning movie. It really predates a lot of J-horror, particularly a movie called The Ring. This is a movie...
J-horror being Japanese.
Japanese, horror. Yeah. Genre horror. So a lot of his tropes are still being enacted today. I will start with this first small clip, and I'll just sort of walk us through this scene once we get on a little bit. This is about a girl named Melissa.
Ciao. Come ti chiami?
Melissa. Mi chiamo Melissa. Thank you.
Melissa. Melissa.
Please let the eyes work.
Okay, and now here's where things get interesting before we head into the next scene. Melissa, and what differentiates Kill Baby Kill from a lot of the movies that this may remind you of, movies where let's see how many cobwebs we can put in the set, how many blue lights we can turn on, and how wide of an angle lens we can use. What's interesting about this is that Melissa is actually a ghost, but not a real ghost. She is a ghost of a little girl who these townspeople in Transylvania trampled during a drunken town festival, and everyone was too inebriated to help her, and she died. The problem is that now, whenever her name is mentioned in the village, she's talked about in any way, her ghost comes to that person, and that person cannot prevent themselves from committing suicide. So that's where you sort of get the J-horror, the ring element. Not only is Melissa someone who causes you to kill yourself, her potential victims hear her in the distance. They think she's coming. It becomes sort of an obsession of anxiety, where it's sort of murder by anxiety, by a spiritual anxiety. Here's a pretty good instance of what I'm talking about in this next scene.
That means nothing.
Thank you, Melissa. My wife's name, incidentally, is Melissa, and I've actually sat and made her watch this film with me a few too many times. She wasn't impressed. Mario Bava is actually a very versatile director. He did things like James Bond movie spoofs. He did Hercules sword and sandal movies several of them. Hercules in the Haunted World is one that's particularly worth checking out. But another great thing about Mario Bava is that he's quintessentially Italian. While on the one hand, he's making films where he's seeing how many spikes, rods, and penetrations he can put through his victims' bodies. They are extremely gory. Very often, his films tie things back to the family. The following, in a big way, as you're about to see. The following and last couple clips I'm going to show you here are from sort of his version of a trilogy of terrors, a movie called Black Sabbath, which came out in 1963. This is from the middle episode where, I'll give a little backstory here, Boris Karloff is the family patron of an estate in the Carpathian Mountains and goes up hunting a famous vurdulac, which is a Romanian term for a vampire, a particularly bloody vampire, very feral.
So it's a bunch of Italians making movies about how crazy Romanians are.
Actually, the reason Mario Bava would choose locations like these Viennese castles and Transylvanian and in the Carpathian Mountains for the same reason that we find them very horrifying. It's not that horrifying to make films about, you know, Milan. So
that depends.
Or wait, I guess it may
be. Berlusconi's made some pretty horrifying films.
He did make some pretty horrifying films, but in terms of like horror tropes, in order, it's an effective horror shorthand in Italian as it is in English. Yeah. When you talk about Transylvania, boom, you're there. And the main thing was about getting these films done extremely cheaply. Most of the money was spent on fake blood and on lights, and getting them made as fast as possible. I think Black Sabbath, the entire film, not just this middle segment that you're seeing excerpts from here, was made in like 10 or 11 days. So these were done very fast. They'd be picked up by distributors like Roger Corman's American International Pictures, and they would actually, they'd be made for almost nothing, and they still wouldn't make that much when they were distributed, but they would be dubbed to so many countries and became, you know, shown as part of this sort of grindhouse circuit that's, you know, sort of been made famous by the filmmakers that are sampling it today. And eventually they'd make, you know, $300,000. But the budget for the film was 60. So these were cataclysmic hits. And so they were always aped and aped and aped. So all these Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing movies all not only derived their sort of working style from a lot of these early 60s giallo directors, they also got their colors, their actors, and many of their plots. The impalement plots, his early films became big, like Black Sunday and Black Sabbath, every film had to have some sort of violent impalement, every horror movie. And he's largely to thank for this. He's not a sleek stylist. I mean, I love the films of Dario Argento. They're ethereal and beautiful. But in terms of rote film horror filmmaking, this is great. And there's also a certain neutrality of it, which makes my obsession with reusing it so easy to do. So anyway, a short scene from Black Sabbath with the great Boris Karloff. I may do a little translating.
Oh, wait. No, it's on.
It's on. So here, Boris Karloff is returning from 5 days in the mountains after chasing a vampire hunter, and his family is suspicious of him.
Oh, this does look true.
How come no one's giving me a hug? Okay, so everyone thinks he's a vampire. The first thing the vampire says is, "How come nobody's giving me a hug?"
Sorry. Sono ferito. Perché mi guardate senza parlare?
Why do you look at me without speaking? Tech, sorry. Okay. So why do you look at me without speaking? So later that night, Well, he does this. It's his grandson. Okay, so of course, this being the family obsession of the directors that I was telling you about, that baby's got to come home.
Per l'amor del cielo, Maria, non lo ascoltare.
Ma è mio figlio, mi sta chiamando, Alfredo.
Ma è morto, morto. Ragiona, tu stessa lo hai seppellito con le tue mani.
Lasciami andare, Alfredo, devo aprirgli.
Tuo figlio è un Vordalak.
Non mi importa, lasciami o ti uccido.
I love you, Grandpa. These are a couple of the reasons why I'm particularly obsessed with the films of Mario Bava.
Brandon Dowling, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I'll tell you why I asked about the Romanian thing was because I teach in Berlin, and I've got a lot of students from Eastern Europe, and I had one time it was a studio class, and I asked them all to come in and give a presentation on an artist whose work they totally hated. And I'm always kind of interested in like why it would be Romanians, you know, who just sort of become like the big horror icon. And this Romanian woman came in, and she brought a presentation by some Romanian. I think she brought in some artist by some Romanian person whose name I can't remember. And it was kind of like really over the top, and you know, really kind of. And she's like, yeah, and that's why my country's so messed up, because we're absolutely medieval. And then this, I think she was a Serbian woman came in, and she gave a presentation on Marina Abramović, who was her least favorite artist in the world, and she talked about this Abramović piece where it's the Balkan Baroque thing, where she talks about how Serbs get rid of a rat, or how you get rid of a rat infestation. Have you guys seen this? Okay, for those who haven't, like basically it's from an old folk. Recipe for getting rat extermination, which is, since rats won't attack their own, you grab one rat, you starve it for 2 weeks so its teeth grow really sharp and long, then you blind it like with a stick, so that it goes absolutely, you know, kind of crazy and is furious, and then you drop it back into the rabbit warren, at which point it's so crazed and hungry and paranoid that it will attack anything that comes near it, right? So it will eliminate the entire den except for the alpha rat, which will eliminate it. And then she kind of finished her presentation on why Marina Abramović sucks, and she's like, and that's why my people are so goddamn medieval. And so I was like, well, okay, which of the two of you, the Romanian and the Serbian, you know, which one would you say is more bloodthirsty, and you know, and which one would you say is more medieval? of the two countries, and the Serbian chick just kind of paused, and she's like, "Well, we're more experimental." So, and that was that. Our next guest has actually starred in a few horror movies. He has also been in Fringe. As a matter of fact, most of the clips I've seen of him online have had to do with horror films. So please welcome Spencer List. Oh, wait, yeah. Well, no, we should, yeah, come on, Spencer. Just before that happens, any initial thoughts off of...
No, I still need one.
Oh, everyone doesn't have one yet. Okay, so we're still serving. All right, hi.
Hey.
Thank you for coming. So Spencer has been in The Bereaved and in Orphan Killer, is that
it? Yeah, Bereavement.
Bereavement and Orphan Killer and in Fringe. So what's a normal, before we get to the horror stuff, so how many auditions do you go on a month?
Well, it depends on, like, if it's going well, if the acting job is going well. But I'd say it's more business in L.A. than there is in New York, because there's probably about one audition a week usually.
In New York or
yeah,
in L.A.?
In New York. In L.A. there's usually like three or four jobs a week.
So how do you, but your family lives in New York?
Yeah.
So do you travel to L.A. for? Or?
Yeah, me and my sister actually went to L.A. and surprisingly, my sister, which was really awesome, is she got a Disney show, and she's playing one of the leads in it, so it's really cool. Yeah.
So she's in L.A. now?
Yeah, she's in L.A. now. Right. She's filming.
Okay, so but you living in New York, you do like one audition a week, two auditions a week?
Yeah.
And how many, I mean, how often do you land a part out of those auditions?
Well, usually I'd say about, like, 4 or 5 months sometimes. Or,
4 or 5 months.
Yeah, sometimes like that.
And are there, do you find you get type, I mean, do you find you get typecast? Are there parts you like, I mean, do you, yeah.
Yeah, well, sometimes you have to read the script, or my agent reads the script, or my manager reads the script, so, and I also have to like it, and I have to like the character.
Okay, so what goes into liking a character or not liking a character?
Well, I'm kind of, like, trying not to do any horror films anymore, because I've kind of, like, been, like, so on that, so I'm trying to kind of do comedy now, so I'm basically looking at, like, funny roles and really obnoxious roles and stuff.
And obnoxious roles being what?
Yeah, like kind of some people being like stuck up, like, "Hey, what's going on, man? Yeah, what's going on? You know, I'm so great. Yeah, you know me."
Oh, like Jada.
Like that. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So, do you find yourself playing? I mean, do you find yourself playing older or younger than you? You're 13, right?
Yeah, I'm 13, but I'm really tall for my age, so. People would usually put me, it was great. I actually have a funny story. Me and my mom were going to audition for 15-year-old. And this guy went in, and he was like 24, and he had like muscles and stuff and like biceps. And he was like 6'4" or something. And he came out, and he's like, "Good luck, guys." And I was like,
But wait, he was already in it, or he?
Yeah, no, he was waiting outside with us, and I was like, oh. "Who's this guy going for?" And I looked at the sign-in, and he was like, "Oh my God, he's going the same role as me." I was like, "Oh my God!"
Wow.
And all the other guys were like, "This, not good."
But he probably didn't get it, right? He probably just.
Yeah, I don't think he got it. Yeah.
So, do you like playing older or younger?
Sometimes I like playing Basically, I like playing my age mostly, but if I had to do one, I'd probably play older.
Older?
Yeah.
Do you feel like, you're 13, right?
Yeah, 13.
Do you feel like, I mean, this would be a question about horror movies too, but even comedy, do you feel like when people write parts for, because the people writing parts for 13-year-olds are mostly like 30 and up most of the time. Do you feel like that has anything to do with your experience of being 13?
No, I think they actually just write the part and they want to see who gets it, so they just write it for really anyone, and they write it just particularly for a younger kid or an older kid.
Do you get parts where you're like, "Wow, this is really what it's like to be a 13-year-old kid," or do you feel like you get parts where you're like, "This is some 40-year-old's idea of what it's like to be a kid"? Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, sometimes it's like, this is not really like me, but most of the time, I'd have to say, yeah, this is like me. I really like this part. Like, my last part that I just got, which was called Bringing Up Bobby, It was a lot like me, and it was so much fun filming and everything.
Why was it a lot like you?
Well, it was a lot like me because I'm basically a kid in middle school, and I am basically just like him. He's, but one thing is, I'm not a con artist like he is. He's a con artist, and so is his family, but I'm pretty comedic. I get that from my dad. My dad's pretty comedic. Yeah,
he's the guy back there.
Yeah, he's born on April Fool's, so I think I get it from him.
So then when you have to play a part, what's the part that's most not like you that you've ever had to play?
Well, a part that's not like me is I played a killer, and I have to, like, kill him and stab him, and that's not really like me. And also, I'd, like, eat this guy's ear off once and stuff. I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm really bloodthirsty, so I think I'm going to stay away from that sometimes.
Okay, so what do you have to do when you have to play a part that's not like you? Like, how do you prepare a character like that?
I don't really go into the part like, oh man, I gotta take 30 minutes for this. I really gotta take 30 minutes for this. I'm just... I just go in and I'm like, all right, let's go. I'm ready for this. And I had to do tears in one scene, and I did 7 takes of tears. So I just went into it, and then they're like, oh, are you okay? I was like, yeah, I'm great. How's it going? And so also, it's really easy. I felt like I was just being me when I was, like, eating people's ears off and stuff. It was just like, yeah, this is just a normal day in the life of Spencer List, you know.
Huh. But do you, so you're just eating people's ears, just being you and, like,
yeah,
kind of cracking up about it. Like,
yeah.
I've seen clips from this movie. It's extreme. Like, I mean, the trailer's like, the trailer's something like, you know, goes even further than Saw. Like,
yeah.
This is the one, right? With the, yeah.
There was also the
Orphan Killer.
One was called Bereavement, and then another was called Orphan Killer, and then another one was called Offspring. So those were like the 3 like really crazy ones.
So does it get you down doing that? I mean,
well, yeah, Bereavement, I was shooting for like 3 months, and my dad said that I was just looking a little bit gloomy. I was shooting in Pennsylvania. And I actually got taken out on my Halloween, and I was like, my mom bought me a present, and I was like, yes, because I love horror. So she bought me a Chucky mask, and I wore that to, what was it called? It was like Robin or something, Red Robin. And they gave me candy. I was like, yay. It's funny. And they started like, they're like, oh, how's it going today? And my dad was like, yeah. Yeah, we're just
this
going
is little
here.
Chucky.
Yeah, it's just Chucky, you know.
Did you like horror before you started shooting all these horror films?
Yeah, I started liking horror films in about like 3rd grade.
Okay. Yeah. Why? What was the first one?
I just started liking it because my parents were watching it, and one of my favorite is Dexter. I love that show. That's like my favorite show ever. I love Dexter because he basically solves the problem for everyone. He kills people that are bad. So I'm just like, you know what? I want to be like that guy. He's so cool. He kills people that are like really mean.
So wait, how does it feel? How does it feel making movies that your friends aren't allowed to see?
Yeah, it feels kind of sad because like all of your friends are like, "Hey, what's going on?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I just shot this film." And, "Oh yeah, you guys should watch it." "Oh, sorry. My parents don't let me watch like R-rated films." I'm like, what? My parents let me watch everything. I'm like, man, these people are crazy.
What? Okay, so then why stop the horror? I mean, was it just because you wanted to diversify your career, or was it because you?
Well, I really wanted to do something else. I didn't want to be known as the horror kid. Like I see on the internet, it's like he is the horror kid. This is just blood and everything to him. And
that's what you're called.
Yeah. Like, I'm just, like, called the horror kid. So I'm just like, you know what? I think I'm going to start doing some comedy and stuff. And plus, I like comedy better. I think I really have a comedic timing and stuff. That's what my, yeah.
So your next film is going to be a comedy, or you already shot it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. And you play a what again?
I play a con artist with my mom.
So now you're just going to be the con artist. Oh, wait, this is the
Bring Up Bobby, yeah.
Right, okay.
And it actually was screened at Cannes, so that was cool.
Did you go?
No, I didn't, because that's like far away. So.
So how does it feel making films that you're not allowed to go see? So do you want to do this? You want to keep doing? I mean, because you want to keep doing acting, like when you.
Yeah, I love acting. The two things that I love the most are acting and basketball. Two things I love most.
Okay, but then if you're not, but you said you're not really acting when you're acting. Like you mostly are just like, you're just being you, and then you're chewing on ears, right?
Yeah.
So then, what's so awesome about being an actor if you're not acting?
Well, when you have silent roles, you mostly my character in Fringe was silent, and mostly I felt in some roles I just be myself. But in different roles, like, you really have to change your character. Like, I had to play a kid that was just silent. I had to do everything with my eyes. And so that was pretty fun.
So how did you change your character? Just by restricting what you could do physically, or?
Yeah, basically. I just did everything I knew and everything everyone taught me. So I really never went to an acting school. So I basically just channeled everything that I know for myself. Like, if I'm angry, I use it from some time that I was angry from, or if I'm sad, I just use it from time.
And using it means what? Like you like relive it, or you just remember what you looked like, or what it feels
like? I just
like?
Remember it. Yeah. Like I feel bad if something makes me really sad. I just use it to cry, or if something makes me really mad, I just like start to hit the table. I'm like, I'm mad. You know me. I'm mad. I'm mad. Mad like a villain.
Like that.
Yeah.
All right, do you guys have questions?
She's got a great
answer. All right.
Can we get the microphone, actually?
No, I think this goes under the not smelling and the not.
Oh.
And the not recruiting.
Okay.
Will you cry for us right now?
I probably actually could. Maybe. We'll try. Oh, not right now.
That was pretty good, and I feel really terrible for asking.
That was
well like child
played.
Abuse. What did you have to think? What were you thinking of just then?
Right now.
In order to cry.
Well, I was thinking of sometimes my. I was thinking of something like really sad. One time, it was just really sad. Yeah, I don't know if I can say it. It was actually when my dad lost his dad, and it was really sad for him. And he told me that to cry. So, yeah, that was trying to make me cry.
He told you not to cry, or he told
no,
you?
No, that's how he's telling me to cry. Like he lost his dad. That just made me sad. So, when he was 16. So yeah.
Your brother's got a question.
Well, how do you usually like, think of it? Does he tell you to think of it, the thing?
No. Sometimes I just do it. I just do it myself. But yeah, that particular moment when I was shooting the film, he told me to do that, and yeah.
So he told you to think of how you'd seen him.
Yeah.
Are most of your friends actors? I mean, are there people who, like?
Well, my best friends aren't really actors. Like my best friend I knew from Florida, and his name is Trace. But my other best friends, yeah, some of them are from acting. Most of them.
And are they? I mean, do you guys see each other around auditions or?
Yeah, we sometimes see each other on auditions, but not most of the time now because we're not really going to a casting director. When you go to a casting director, then you actually see them. But when you actually have to send the tape to LA, then you go to your agency and you tape it. So.
Okay, so a lot of the time you're sending tape.
Yeah.
To LA. Do you, most actors hate going on tape? I mean, do you?
Yeah, I kind of don't really like going on tape because it doesn't really show how much, like, really good you are. And I think it shows better in person how good of an actor you are. So.
Jessica, question. You first.
Are you inspired by other child actors?
I'm not inspired by child actors, but my big inspiration is Johnny Depp. I really like him. Or Johnny Depp or Leonardo DiCaprio. Those are my two.
Why?
I like Johnny Depp because really he's just like a menace to society. He's a rebel. I want to be like him. I want to be like, yeah, I don't care about this. What? You think I care about this? No, I don't care about this. You know me.
But Leonardo cares about this.
Yeah, he cares about that. And But the one thing I like that about Johnny Depp, but the one thing I like about Leonardo DiCaprio is his acting style. Like he's always plays emotional roles usually. And I loved him in Inception. I thought he was really good. Like I saw that when I was actually shooting my film last year. So, yeah, I really liked that. That was really good.
Do you go to school?
Yeah, I actually go to an online school, and I finished last Wednesday, so I just, like, did it really fast so I could finish early and play my video games and stuff.
Okay.
I've got a question, and then declare. So, look, I mean, your dad is obviously awesome. We were hanging out beforehand. But
awesome. He plays video games with me. It's cool.
That's awesome. Your brother is also obviously awesome. But I guess my question is, like, because there's this cliche of, like, the stage parent, you know? Do you know any kids where you're like, oh my god, their mother's a monster?
Well, it's actually a dad. This kid's name is Seamus. I don't know his dad's name, but he always comes in, he's like, hey, how's it going, guys? And I'm like, oh my god, not this guy again. Oh Jesus.
The dad.
What? Yeah, oh, the dad. He's just like, and he's like, come on, you gotta book this.
Oh really?
Yeah. I don't know. I just think he's like really into it. And actually when I booked it, the director, she was like, yeah, there were some people that I didn't think their parents were really good with the children, and I was like, yeah, it's probably Seamus' dad. Man, that guy's a freak.
But is Seamus a mess, or is this
no,
his dad?
He's actually a really nice kid, but his dad's just, like, crazy. He's like, hey, guys, what's going on? I'm like,
wow, okay, so.
Yeah, he's just really weird.
This is kind of a silly question, but these ears that you ate, what were they made of? Like, this is something I always wonder when I watch.
Yeah, this was it was makeup, and it was a makeup artist would put like a plastic ear or something on him, and the blood was actually just actually syrup. Yeah, corn syrup. The blood. I actually spit it out, so, because they told me not to drink it, so I was just like, yeah.
Thanks. So you've done these horror films, and I mean, this goes back to David's comment about how these were all written by adults. I mean, you know that the reason that kids are in horror films is that adults are sort of secretly terrified of you. Like, you seem like a really nice kid, but there are, like, a lot of us in this room who are, like really, like, if you stopped us in, a dark alley, we would, like, freak. Right, and like I'm just like wondering, like having been on the other side of that, I mean, do you get to like lord that knowledge? Like when you see adults, you like know that like there we have this sort of innate terror of you just because you're a kid.
When I do my scary face, no one wants to get near me. I'm like,
I would imagine, yeah, especially with like good lighting, yeah.
Okay, and, what's the scary face? Let's get it over with. Jesus. All right. Yeah, I can see. Yeah, all right.
That's my scary face. And also in the film, I was also wearing a mask, and so my eyes would get like really messed up, and they'd be like,
Wait, which?
They'd be really scared.
Which film? The Orphan
Killer. The Orphan Killer, yeah.
Oh yeah, I saw that's like when she's driving away, and you're standing there in that freak out mask.
Oh yeah, and then the director told us the older version of me. Told us that he booked it because when he walked in, he was just really freaky. They freaked him. They were freaked out by him. He was just so scary.
Did you think any of those movies? This is a terrible thing to say, and you can't go on the record with this. But did you think those were good horror movies? The ones that you were in, or can you even look at them as good or bad once you're in them?
I would say they are. The one film that I thought turned out bad, because he really didn't do the lighting properly, and everything was great, but he messed it up, I thought. And I think that was Offspring, because we had, like, me and my friend, we were together for about the whole summer, and we'd just play Xbox and video games together, and we'd be shooting it, and there was actually this great fight scene that we had together. And some guy helped us for like 2 hours with it, and it was crazy. It looked really awesome. And then the lighting was terrible, so you couldn't see it. I was like, oh, man, I spent like 3 hours on that. I spent till, I think that was like 6 o'clock in the morning doing that. And I started at 4 o'clock, maybe, something like that. I don't know. It's crazy, yeah.
Have you ever chewed a director out?
What?
Have you ever chewed a director out?
No, I haven't, because... I don't really want to be mean to them. I mean, it was also after the film, right. So you couldn't really say anything. But, yeah, I really think the directors I worked with are very descriptive. They work on it a lot, and they just know what they're going to do. So, and if it's bad, they're going to reshoot it. So that's why I don't think it's that bad, but... That one came out bad because they probably didn't reshoot it.
And Offspring, you were the Offspring.
Yeah,
you guys were the villains.
Yeah, a whole bunch of cannibals. I was one of the cannibals, and that's why I bit someone's ear off.
Gotcha.
Can I ask?
So, did it take you a while to get, the first time you went on an audition, right? But I mean, did it take you a while to get the whole thing of like, you know, agent casting agent going on tape? Da, 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 da. Did you have to shop around for an agent for a while? Were you sending in headshots? What were you?
No, because actually I was modeling before I was acting, and so my manager, she got us into an agent, and then just recently, last year, when my sister booked Dire Wimpy Kid 2, we switched to Paradigm. It's a new agency, so, yeah.
Okay, so you didn't have to go all through that, like, that whole thing?
No, not really, but we had to audition for the Abrams, but we didn't have to audition for the other one.
So is Paradigm sort of consulting with you when they're like, we also don't want you to do any more horror movies? I mean, have they got like a plan for you or?
No, because really, they want me to do whatever I want to do. But they said to my parents that they don't really want us to do any guest star stuff. So they don't really want us to do any like short stuff. Like say I'm the last character. I'm not very big. They don't really want us to do anything that's not really big.
But TV, like guest star on Law and Order, that's okay, right?
Yeah, I would say so. Actually, they were fighting us on that before, that we can't do it on Law and Order either. Because I was actually auditioning for it, and they said no, that I couldn't do it.
Because it'll mess with your brand, or?
I guess so. Yeah, I think that they're a big agency, and they don't want us to do that kind of stuff.
They don't want to be known.
Yeah, they don't want to be known as just little stuff.
Right.
I guess.
They're keeping you from acting then, right? I mean, it's...
Not really, because there's a lot of movies and stuff, and TV jobs, there's only a couple, like, there's probably like 3 or 4 a year for auditions, so.
Any other?
Are New York acting kids different than LA acting kids?
Yes, because I think New York kids are much better. I think LA kids are just like over the top, and they're just really—they sound like almost messed up because their parents probably torture them into doing it. But our New York kids are just like, we want to do this. We're not like those LA kids, and we don't get like sucked into this and stuff like that.
Would you say better in terms of they're better people, or they're better actors, more professional?
We're also better actors too.
as well.
Yet another east side, west side problem. All right.
Yeah.
Can I wanted to know about this category. You're in films that you're not allowed to see that we picked up before. Were you invited to the premiere of some of these films, or could you not actually go into the premiere of the film?
Well, they
it's
said
that the law allows you to be in them, but you can't see them. I think that's a very interesting moment in the law.
Yeah, I actually, when I was in third grade, I shot Breedment, and they said, "Oh, you're definitely not going to the premiere." I was like, "Oh, dang!" But
just to give you background, Breedment, he plays, let's forget this right, he plays a kid who's actually been held hostage by a serial killer for, like, what, 10 years?
Yeah.
So he can watch the serial killer torture other people to death? Is that?
Yeah. And so they wouldn't let me go to the premiere, but it took them a long time to develop it and everything. So I was in fourth grade probably, and when they came out with it, I was in sixth grade. So they're like, "Oh, fine, you can come to the premiere." It's like, yeah. Huh. I'm going to the premiere, and all of the people in the cast were there and everything. And my sister was also in the film, so that was my first time acting with my sister.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah, are you constantly amazed by the difference when you look back at these films between being on the set watching something, because you must have a lot of distance towards it then, yeah, where you've got all the cameras around and people and directors and people, you know, makeup and all the rest of it, and then how it looks on screen, because you seem so well adjusted. And, you know, and if I'd seen that kind of, if I'd seen what you'd seen at your age, I think it would be a different story.
Yeah, well, I actually know now that it's all fake, and I've seen behind the scenes, and the people who are actually supposed to be really messed up are really nice. And there was actually this one funny thing when I came to set and I was wearing this Joker hat because Joker's my favorite villain, and he was like, "Hey, what's going on, Joker?" And he's like in this character. I was like, "Ah!" Because he goes like really into character once he's in character.
Oh, this is the guy with the crazy eyes?
Yeah.
Ah.
It was funny.
Do you ever get the longing to do, like, domestic drama or something? Like, Kramer versus Kramer or some kind of thing? Like, you know, where you're just, like, a poor, normal 13-year-old kid? Or is it, like...
I would probably do that, yeah.
Would it be weird just trying to play a kid under normal circumstances?
No, I wouldn't say so, because usually you act and you see other people doing this, and then you can basically get a good sense of what you're doing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Your last two roles.
My last two roles have been normal. I was there, yeah.
Does that feel weird? Like, I guess what I'm saying is, like, it's actually, I kind of get that. It's easier to be yourself when you're, it's really easy to be yourself when you're chewing on an ear, because the main task is, like, chewing on an ear, and you can just be like, whatever. But, I mean, if you have to play, like, just a normal kid, does that feel, like, stranger, or does that...
Not really, because I just feel like I'm being myself. But Foreclosure was normal, but it also had some crazy aspects where he was actually getting possessed by this jacket. He put it on, and he got possessed, and he tried to kill me. So,
who tried to kill you?
What? My father in the movie, who was Michael Imperioli, and he tried to kill me, and he'd try to hang me, and then I escaped, and next year.
Normal kid stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Last question.
It's just a side question. Did you see Tree of Life?
Tree of Life.
Tree of Life. Sorry.
Tree of Life. I don't think so. Or right. I might have, but I just don't remember it.
Okay, thanks. Sorry.
any other questions about what he's seen? Or
one more question.
Okay, one more
yes.
question.
I love that movie. It's like.
Did you see Joshua?
What?
Joshua?
No.
Oh, all right.
My dad showed me Exorcist, though. I like that movie.
One question back
there. I was putting on my jacket, but I can ask a question.
Yeah, you go.
Yes, please.
I hope you don't take offense.
It's totally true.
Thank you. I hope you don't take offense to this question, but what do you think about what critics
say about young children that act in scary movies that it psychologically has an impact on the children?
Good question.
Well, I basically say, you know what, I don't really think most of that is true because a lot of kids, they don't get affected by it. I don't think really anyone does because they know that it's all fake and they see the blood. And I was looking at the blood makers and I was talking about them, to how they make the blood and stuff. And I was like, wow, this is really cool how you do all this. Can I take some home? And they were like, yeah, sure. And I actually took some home. It was really cool. So I don't really think anyone gets affected by it because they know it's fake and they talk to the makeup artist and everyone.
And you guys probably know it's fake even better than an audience knows it's fake.
Yeah.
Anything else? All right. Spencer, thank you very much. Oh, I have a last question. You said you were a basketball fan and you're from Florida.
Yeah.
So were you devastated?
No, I was actually, my dad's from Ohio, so I like Cleveland. I was just, I was really mad at LeBron. I was just so upset at him. I'm never going to be a fan of LeBron ever again. I'm just so mad at him.
All right.
He made me really mad.
Cool. Good to know. All right, so the evening is drawing to a close. Evan, would you want to recap for a moment what is in that cocktail? Which is louder in the microphone. That's what it's for.
Gin, vermouth, clarified lime juice, and rhubarb.
Brad, we're really going with the rhubarb here. We've got about five for you.
All
right.
Gin, vermouth, clarified lime juice, and rhubarb.
Rhubarbia.
Rhubarbarella. The demon rhubarber of Fleet Street.
It's a good thing I have no cocktail menus to put this on right now. That's great. Right.
Yeah. Okay, this area is done.
Okay. Anything else?
RuPaul.
Come on, what?
Peach fuzz? Fuzzy.
A slightly recondite suggestion, which is lavender mist.
Oh.
Right.
And anyone with that sort of take this job and shove it persona in the art would be Jackson Pollock, and he's making luxury goods.
Yes.
Lavender mist, not
lavender
bad.
Lavender mist.
I was thinking, I mean, the rhubarb is really strong, but it's actually the lavender that comes from the top. Mm-hmm. So I did come up with one name, which was Nice.
Yeah. Excellent.
In the kind of art history vein, you could call lavender disaster,
too. That's right. Wow.
You could call it the lavalier, I guess. But
yeah.
Any other suggestions? No.
Right.
All right. I'm going to whittle it down to three, unless anyone has
okay.
any suggestions. So, lavender mist is on for sure.
We have to acknowledge one of the great rhubarb puns.
What? Lavender. Yeah. MISSED. A lavender mist. Evan wants to, you can tell the story later. Okay, so lavender mist, rhubarbia. What were your eight again? We pick one. Let's say rhubarbarella.
Rhubarbarella is the best one, I think.
Okay, rhubarbarella, lavender mist, nice. Going once, going twice, last entries. Okay, lavender mist, rhubarbarella, or nice. Show of hands for Nice.
All right.
Show of hands for Lavender Mist. Oof, that's pretty overwhelming. Okay, but that leaves Rhubarbarella. We need to do a count. I didn't count. I thought
that one.
What's that? Okay, so Rhubarbarella, one. Keep your arms up. One, two, three. You're underage. You're not allowed to vote. And you're double underage. Okay, fine. What? You're not allowed to see movies or vote. One, Okay, okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I can't count. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 for Rhubarbarella. Right?
All right. 14.
Okay. 14 for Rhubarbarella. Lavender Mist. Oh, this is so close. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15.
Closest yet.
You get to call it what you like, ultimately. But it will go down in history as Lavender Mist. Thank you all for coming. Hang out. Ask Evan questions. And thank you to everybody who presented a lot.